I'm Representative Gardner, Chair of the Subcommittee for Drinking Water Source Protection. We had some audio problems in here yesterday, and I was advised that we're going to minimize feedback if people turn off their cell phones and PDAs. And it was very hard for those of us at the Capitol. Put my own speed by. Lead by example. I wasn't going to wait for a forum today. We're not taking any official action, but as I've been for the last 7 or 8 months looking at issues of protecting our drinking water in Minnesota, it became very apparent in my own district and in other districts that there are things you just don't legislate on drinking water source protection, but there are things that are very procedural and governmentally in nature that we have to deal with. You'll hear about North Oaks in my district, but one thing I've discovered is that not all the agencies that need to talk to each other do so, and not all the cities and state agencies that communicate in a way that I think yields timely resolution to drinking water contamination issues. So today is really just a listening session for us. We do a lot of talking in the legislature, especially last night when we didn't finish on the floor until 1 o'clock. But today is a chance just to listen, and I specifically asked if representatives of several cities in the Twin Cities metro area could come in and really tell their story about how they came across contamination of residential wells as well as the municipal water supply, what process they had to do to secure a clean and safe drinking water supply, and what issues remain. I'm not really out here to get anybody in any agency or anything like that. I just would like to hear from you, and I think we'll just get right started. What time do we have to be out here? 2? And I have St. Louis Park, North Oaks, Lakeland, and Lake Elmo here. And what I was thinking I'd do is maybe have, why don't you plan on talking for 10 minutes each, and then we can do some Q&A, and then that usually means we'll stretch it out a little bit longer. But I want to make sure that I'm respectful of all your time. Everybody's taken a lot of time to come down here today. Could I have St. Louis Park, Mr. Brian Hoffman, come up? And I saw you a while ago, and you've got vapor issues.
Yes. Thank you.
Tell us more.
Thank you, Representative Gardner. Brian Hoffman with the City of St. Louis Park, and I've been project managing our vapor intrusion study that's been going on here. Hey, a little overview of what it is. It is based on groundwater, and this was sort of a new type of experience for us, and working with the various agencies, it seems like it's sort of a new concern, environmental concern all around. It started a couple of years ago when the city of Edina actually noticed some VOC contamination in one of their wells, contacted the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, who started basically studying this to try to find the source, and that ended up coming into St. Louis Park, basically following the direction of groundwater flow. What we found instead was not necessarily the source, but we found VOCs in the shallow groundwater, not the deep aquifers, but up fairly shallow close to the surface. They had been a number of tests in the right-of-way and observed the VOCs and the vapor that comes up. VOCs, basically just like gasoline, if it was spilled on the ground, evaporates, and it evaporates underground as well. And so our groundwater contamination was vaporizing and coming up through the soil as a VOC vapor. Realizing that this involved a fairly large area, a neighborhood area, the EPA contacted the Environmental Protection Agency, which came in, which had experience in Ohio with a similar type of situation. And that led to basically the city, last August, September, starting to work with the PCA, the MDH, two state agencies, and the U.S. EPA, as far as how we would undertake this procedure and this study. And that was fascinating because I think it was a learning experience for all of us. And what's happened over the past few months is we've actually come to admire the resources at both the NVHPCA as well as just how well the federal EPA has responded. We're studying an area that involves over 300 properties right now, houses and commercial businesses. And we're in the process right now. The EPA is doing this. They're basically picking up the tab. We're taking air samples from beneath the slab under all these buildings to see if the vapor through the soil is coming up beneath the building. And then if it is, finding high VOC levels. Now they're going inside and testing the indoor air level for VOC levels. Right now, we do not have the results yet of the indoor for all the properties. However, out of the over 300, we found about 45 with very high VOC levels beneath the slab that triggered the indoor air quality testing. If we have high indoor air levels, the EPA will basically be putting mitigation systems in for those residential properties, which is a subslab depressurization for removal of the vapors. That's sort of phase one of the program. Phase two is going to start this spring, where the PCA and EPA working together are going to be taking a look at, okay, where did the source of this come from? So they're going to look further through right-of-way vapor samples and groundwater sampling, trying to identify the source, the responsible party, and then find out if this is an old contamination from decades ago or if this is something that may still be occurring, and then come up with a plan to solve the problem. So the mitigation is to remove or to alleviate any potential indoor health threats to the residents. And then the long-term plan, of course, is to eliminate the VOC contamination in the groundwater. Probably be done through some combination of pumping and purifying the VOC levels. That's still sort of, right now, the only part of that we really are understanding is that it will be starting this spring, and that still we'll have to see. So we learned some things through this. One, when you're dealing with over 300 residents who are affected, it's not a municipal drinking water issue, but it's an indoor air quality issue for these people now. And so it hits home, so to speak. We knew that it would be potentially very serious for these people when they're all of a sudden told they may have VOCs in their house. So working with the agencies, we realized really early on, we have to work together. There's just absolutely no way we're going to be able to make this go through and serve our residents without working together. And I think it was sort of a learning experience for all the agencies, the MDH, taking the health aspect because of the indoor air, the PCA, the groundwater, and then the US EPA basically with the funding and resources to do the testing. So we're trying to understand what part we're each going to play in this. And we stumble a little bit, but in the end, it's working amazingly well. Through communication, being totally open and transparent, trying to clarify who does what through the public process. And making sure that after we have good communication responsibility, it's time to take it out to the public in the right way. Mailing, public meetings, besides the EPA doing it directly, as a city, we're trying to reach out to people. And so by doing that, we have found that about 85% of the properties in the study area signed access agreements and allowed for testing on the site. And you think, well, 85%? When we started out, we'd figure, well, who wouldn't want to be part of this and get 100%? Well, the EPA said their experience is usually in a community only 40 to 50% of the property owners will ever agree to go along with the testing and be part of the study because of fears or not knowing or potential implications. So we feel that really by trying to go all out with the public process, the notifications, working with the residents, and that was, I think, our city's main job in this, is just trying to make sure the residents could always get questions answered and whatever information could get out to them, really helped calm the fears of those people living in those 300 properties. The one area that is probably yet going to come up that we discovered with this is, in some cases, they may be elevated VOCs beneath the property but not coming in. And the question is going to come up is that homeowner may not still feel real good about it. However, under the EPA protocol, they're not going to get a mitigation system. And EPA is going to test a couple of times, but for commercial property owners or those residential where they're not seeing the high indoor air level, the concern really is, and we're hearing this already, it wasn't about the VOCs, the study, But now it's like, geez, I don't feel good about this. I want to have it mitigated. So what the city sees coming up over the next year is how to deal with those property owners who may not have qualified for mitigation, but yet are feeling a sense of uncomfort living in the property. So we see that probably through this whole process is the one thing that's going to be most critical as far as how we resolve the study and work with the various agencies to find ways to help these people. So that's just an overall summary, and are you going to wait for questions at the end? Or
Sure. Hang on, I got to do a formal thing. Call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Borginius.
Yes. You talked about the plume had moved from Edina up to you. How is the plume being tracked now, and what's the expectation for it?
Mr. Huffman.
The plume actually started in St. Louis Park, and that's what the process is going to be this spring and summer to track the origination of it. We have not heard confirmation that this may be the source of the original well contamination. This may have been a totally separate, independent incident, or maybe there may be a connection between them. But hopefully the PCA and EPA have been working out plans together to try to find that source.
Follow-up, Representative Regan.
Well, beyond finding the source, I mean, I also have a concern about how are we tracking around it to make sure it's not 307 families because it's moving over this way or 311 because it's moving this way.
Committee Chair, Representatives, by doing the subflood sampling and a fair amount of right-of-way testing, soil vapor testing that was done last year, they hopefully getting a clear picture of where the plume is right now, the direction it's moving, and in fact, in just the last couple of weeks, the study area has been expanded slightly to take that into effect. They want to take it another block over to the east, as well as some areas to the west, just to make sure that they're finding the area where the soil vapor concentration tapers off. And specifically what they're finding is PCEs, which are solvent cleaners and dry cleaning components.
Thank you.
Trichloroethylene. Representative Osmond has a question.
Yeah, so one of them was what type of EOC, so I appreciate knowing that. The other is the, when you're talking about under the slabs, are these homes with basements or just they're on slabs?
Hi, Mr. Chair, Representative. Most of the homes have basements, and so they're actually going in. The protocol is to drill a small hole in the concrete slab floor and take an air sample from beneath it. Now, most of the commercial businesses are slab on grade, but you could have elevated VOC beneath the building in either case.
I have two questions. If this is Edina St. Louis Park, your drinking water is from a municipal supply from the river, so, right?
Mr. Chair, the city operates on wells.
Okay.
Our drinking water is from wells.
Oh, from St. Louis Park. Okay.
St. Louis Park, we have our own water system, and it's from wells, and they're tested frequently for a number of
times. So the VOCs are in the superficial layer, not the deeper one that you're getting the drinking water.
That is correct.
But you're monitoring to see if that plume is sinking down into where you get your drinking water?
Correct. The plume, I've been fortunate enough to meet a lot of the scientists and engineers through this process. I myself are not one. But I've been learning that the plume, of course, can move horizontal and vertical as it travels through. And so that is part of what they're looking at. Right now, it has not been traveling vertical down into our municipal water system. And it's been more of the surface groundwater.
And I'm curious what triggered EPA's involvement. How did the federal government decide to participate in this one and say not in others around the metro area?
Okay. Mr. Chair, the initial EPA involvement came at the request of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. They realized that they had a situation involving a large area with a number of properties, and due to the potential of the human health hazards inside the building from breathing VOC levels, the EPA then responded, evaluated the situation, and deemed it was an appropriate use of their resources.
I'm curious about that, how they picked that one in particular.
Two other questions. In past years, I believe we've had two other instances in St. Louis Park. I believe, I suppose it's going from memory, but one was arsenic concerns, and we had quite a cleanup, I think, around, I think that was near one of the wells, actually, I believe. And then we've had some methane gases that we're moving from a landfill. Is this in the same area, or is the water flow underneath either of those areas going in this direction? Or what? Just trying to get some relationship through this past problem.
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chair, committee members, the understanding at the moment is, well, the current problem is not related to past issues. Well, we did have the Riley tar site, different chemicals. So that was initially what the researchers thought, as well, is this coming from a past site, and it is not, from what they can tell. It most likely is from some type of a discharge of a cleaning solvent, and that's not what we were dealing with before. There was also some surface lead contamination that was cleaned up some years ago. So it's been looked at, but it appears as though it's not related to any previous.
Other questions or comments? Are you going to stick around?
Yes, sir.
In case we come full circle.
Okay, very good.
Thank you very much.
Well.
We have a sign-in sheet for you somewhere. I'll chase you down. Let's jump to North Oaks. If Mayor Watson. The tables are turned, Mr. Mayor. Usually I'm on the other side.
We've got some documents that I don't know that they're running off,
You could introduce yourself and your affiliation for the record, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Tom Watson. I'm the mayor of the city of North Oaks. I've lived in the community 25 years, and as the opening paragraph of my document indicates, I was on the city council for 10 years, and I've been mayor the last 8. And unfortunately, this entire matter occurred on my watch, so I'm not sure how I should deal with it, but I'll try to do the best I can. I put an outline together because some that know me knows that I can't spend 10 minutes on this subject. We could spend several hours because I've been involved in this matter actually since the first day the first incident was discovered in the community. The history that I've given you there indicates that there's a long history of commercial use of a dump, which was basically for residential waste for many years, of a private party. They subsequently got into the industrial business, started dumping 55-gallon drums of paint and waste paint solvents from Whirlpool Corporation and Reynolds over on Como Avenue in St. Paul, just up the street. And, of course, naturally, then, over time, the containers deteriorated, and subsequently we found water. How we found it was we had a resident trying to sell a home in 1993 who, through the mortgage process, couldn't get a mortgage because they couldn't pass the well test on the home. The irony of that story is this. It was a young lady pregnant, a pediatrician, on her way to a medical center and relocated to a medical center in the east. So we have somebody that understands the situation quite well. And I've often said to council members to date, I can see her to this day from 1993 as we first dealt with that particular matter. I've given you some more chronology in there, but I think a couple of things that are pretty important. We made a lot of progress in 1993 in two ways. One, we realized when we first learned this, and I believe it was the summer of 93, that we had to do something pretty quick. And we also learned at that time there were probably 12 incidents of hurls that were, in some cases, anywhere from 4 to 8 units. In other words, the standard is 2/10 on vinyl chloride, so we were substantially above that. And those homes that were immediately adjacent to that well. We went to work with our local land company to actually put a water solution in place. And the critical part to that is, even though a lot of the documents, and I gave you a copy of the MPCA's document describing that site, quite often everybody talks about the fact that folks came to the table and put the water solution for 60 homes in place. The truth of the matter is, they were prepared to pay for 12 under the authority of the MPCA's order. we negotiated through other means to get the other 48 in place since the pipe was going into the ground and connections and fittings were already along the street. And because of the severity of the problem, and two, we did it quickly. Most of this was done and installed within a year of the time the first detections were reported to us. We continued on then from 94 to the present time. Oh, incidentally, at that time, they issued a what they call a Minnesota decision document, which remains with us today, has created some basis, obviously, for action on the part of the MPCA. It's also raised many questions, and it has provided answers, and I'll try to touch on a few of those. In 2004, in October, as part of the monitoring program, which was part of that decision document, there was a detection of vinyl chloride in a well on the west side of the lake. There had been one in 1993 as well. There's a picture of Lake Gilfillan in that handout that's the MPCA document, and I also attached it to the very back of mine. It was found in 1983 at a very low level. There was another one found now again in 2004 that was still below the hurl for vinyl chloride, but had some other chemicals in the water as well, all below the hurl. But the combination of those things meant that the health department issued a well advisory advising the homeowners not to use the water for personal consumption. They've continued various monitoring programs since that time. I think a couple of things that are germane in that whole chronology. In the spring of 1995, the MPCA conducted a public hearing in our community, the purpose of which was to, quote, gather information. I don't know how to say it politely because I'm old and I've been at this a long time, but it was the biggest disaster that hit the community in the last 30 months. A gentleman from the MPCA, together with some folks in the community, turned this into a circus and a shouting match and a few other things. Not a whole lot constructively happened. When I came back, I advised the city council we need to talk about this, and the council and I agreed very quickly that any meetings that were going to be conducted on this subject in the community, we were going to be the facilitators, we were going to be the hosts. I think it had a lot to do with the fact that having been shamed once in the spring of 2005, we weren't going to do it again. It was a shame on us if we let that happen to our residents by people that are supposed to be out there watching for our best interest. You will see some other chronologies that, in the chronology of things that took place. There's an awful lot of vertical profiling of the three aquifers that are primary drinking water sources in the community. The St. Peter is probably the most prevalent one in the community, with Prairie du Chien being a source if we had deeper wells in some of those homes. And what you'll see is a lot of the testing that's been done. I would suggest to you that an awful lot of the urgency to do that, aside from just monitoring drinking wells or the drinking water at private wells, private homes, which came as a result of an awful lot of public participation we did in our community. In 2005, 2006, we probably held, I don't know how many public hearings that we, the city, called to invite our residents to come in, bring in the experts from the health department, MPCA, and just about anybody else, and to see if we couldn't figure out how to do this because, frankly, we weren't satisfied with the progress that was being made. And out of that came some various directions and advice. We hired a couple of environmental engineers to help advise us, the city. We paid for that. The facts on page 3, incidentally, we are today, actually I'll hit that here. Minnesota decision document in 1993 indicated there were four what they called objectives, response action objectives, to use their language. Provide source control by reducing the area volume and toxicity of the source. That's probably been done pretty effectively. To eliminate the contamination of the North Pond, establish a new wetland, that was done. To prevent the migration of contaminated groundwater from the site, certainly been mitigated a lot. It hasn't been prevented. And the last is to provide safe drinking water for the residents of North Oaks who have received drinking water advisories. To date, that solution has been bottled water, including some homes from 1993 to the present time that still have bottled water. They don't have anything permanent. Now, that's the exception of the 12 homes on the east side that I indicated that we were involved with an installation of a municipal solution, which meant we put a pipe in the ground and bought water from White Bear Township, our neighbor to the east. The residential well sampling to date involves about 80 residents on the west side of the community. There's still some sampling in the contaminated area that has subsequently been served with municipal water. To date, we are probably impacting about 10% of the community in one form or another, 10% of the households in the community in one form or another, either through testing, having this contamination in their area, or have had contamination, or are actually sitting on a well advisory, or sitting on the fact they've got contamination below the hurl. The profile to date indicates that the sand aquifer has basically been not contaminated. In the area of some of our private homes, the St. Peter definitely has, and there's a couple of layers of the St. Peter in there. There's an upper and lower St. Peter, and there's some of them in some places are contaminated, others are not. And the Prairie du Chien, at least they tell us to date, has not been contaminated. What are some of the primary issues? There's really only one major issue, and that's providing safe drinking water. I think a critical thing for you to know that in our community, about three-quarters of our homes are served by a private on-site well. And at the same time, we have private on-site septic systems, ISPS systems. And before somebody wants to go there and relate the incidence of vinyl chloride or anything else to an on-site septic system, I would invite you to come and take a look at how we manage ISPS in our community. I think we're a poster child for doing it right. And this comes from information from scientists we've had at the University of Minnesota working with us over the years. The MDH establishes the hurls by law. That's a good thing. And I don't have any criticism with that. They've been very responsive to that. They provided good information. The MPCA takes the actions to remediate, to correct the problem. The difficulty with that has been, at the moment, some of that is left to judgment. There is no standard practice in law or otherwise to indicate when they do whatever they choose to do, other than base it on the hurl that's established by the health department.
I'm assuming everyone knows we're talking about health risk limits for hurl. Okay.
And consequently, one of the difficulties we run into the MPCA is we started this in 1993, and we are today still wrestling with the implementation of actions that were called for in 1993. And that hasn't happened. My math tells me that's about 15 years ago. And third item we're dealing with is simply the human fact that we're dealing with known carcinogens. We're dealing with human health. And so many of these people are families, they're families with children in these particular areas, and you can talk about it any way you want. I just came in the door and I'm listening to WCCO talk about Elmer Mondale going through a tumor surgery at Rochester. I can only imagine what's going on in that family. And so we don't have that kind of an incident, but we have the matter all about us, and so it affects lots of people. Prevent the degradation of the aquifer. There's a reference to the Minnesota Groundwater Protection Act of 1989. We want to make sure that certainly people are aware of that and those things are being followed. And to tell you the truth, that's not a topic that comes up, nor is it recited in our community very much as to what that law actually requires. What are some of the issues that I have? The timeliness and delays in implementing permanent solutions is unbelievable. 15 years is way, way too long. The thoroughness and scope and breadth of testing and monitoring, I would suggest at this point the city officials had more of an influence on the breadth and scope of what should be done in a role in which we have no authority other than the fact that we choose to do it. We chose to step in and provide some leadership to this thing because likewise we're involved in, we think at least, having some responsibility for issues around human health and life and safety and matters such as that. Second item I've got in here is water quality alternatives. We asked in 1993 to establish a matrix that would indicate under what circumstances certain response actions would actually be triggered. Again in 2005, together with the council, we issued a paper to the MPCA asking them specifically, and at the time I called it the decision tree. You know how decision modeling works? You get a yes or a no. In other words, if you got an action item that comes up positive, there should be a response action, and it should indicate when and how soon. We've not had an answer to that question today. Now, we're in the middle of MPCA looking at an amendment to the 93 decision document in which there's some attempt to try to describe that. It's certainly far from even close to being complete. As I note in there, the desire for more specificity is directly related to the implementation of the short-term remedy. Now, we bring bottled water in immediately, which is a good thing. But it seems to me the fact that we're sitting around 3 years, and in some case, one case 15 years later, and we haven't moved away from a short-term solution seems to me is kind of strange. The MPCA proposed amendment in 1993. Some of us asked the question why, and as I note in my second bullet, We asked the MPCA and the Attorney General's representative to the MPCA to interpret a part of the document, 1993. There's a figure one in the document that identifies very much the same thing that I've got on the very last page, which is the map of the community. But it takes the specific area and it outlines what they call the service area, the action area, and it labels properties by address. And to this date, and part of those were on the west side of the lake, in other words, where the incidents and where the activity is today, as opposed to 93. To this moment, we have not heard formally from the Attorney General. This day, we've not heard formally from the MPCA about why the specific solutions, the alternative solutions, which include the municipal water supply, the homes on the west side of the community, wouldn't be already acted on. They tell us it wasn't their intent to apply to the west side of the community. All the evidence is there to suggest they must have thought about it. Why would you label the properties?
Mm-hmm.
Bottom line, seems to me somebody should be able to answer what the legal authority is of that particular document, and we can't get it today. And I might note that that lack of response to a resident and to folks that live in the immediate area, to well of us on the council, raises questions about the confidence in our process at the state level, raises questions about the trust we should have in those agencies to look out for private residents. Remember, the property, the responsible parties in this case are not domiciled in Minnesota. One's in the East Coast and one's in Michigan. We became victims of that particular process, but we don't seem to get that action. We've got the fear that's involved. And right now, the fear of number of residents, and there's a couple of them here, would tell you right now, their confidence in this process is that amendment to this 93 decision document would lessen the requirements for response actions, not extend them, not make them more aggressive, not make them more timely, not make the triggers much more transparent and clear as to what you will do, when you will do it, how soon you will do it. Spirit moment is we'll back away from that because we haven't had the kind of response and timeliness to these things that we think should have. I've asked the MPCA to change the word amendment and simply use the word supplement. If you've got new information and you've got new technologies and you've got new potential response actions, granular carbon systems, for example, now let's talk about supplementing the old order. Let's not go in and even tinker with the old order. Let's answer a couple questions that we don't understand. Real estate transactions, you might find this very interesting, and I haven't done the research, but I trust somebody here can probably help us with that. We have people buying homes in the immediate area, including ones that have been tested since 1993. And neither the property owner nor the realtor handling the transaction for the seller have ever disclosed, nor does the listing disclose, that there's ever been any incidents of VOCs in the immediate neighborhood. These are homes that have been actually tested. So we have people who, for example, in two cases that arrived into these homes in the past year and were approached by Conestoga Rovers, who's the engineering firm for the responsible parties, asking about access to the property, which in probably both cases is the first time they ever heard about this matter. This has been in that neighborhood now for over 20 years. And I don't know what the requirements are. Private property frustrations are huge in all of this. In other words, there's a very deliberate, very clear and linear process to follow in all of this. But the fact that we're not doing that, and I just jotted down some thoughts that came to my mind as I was thinking about it. People ask the question about why they shouldn't be frustrated and all the rest. And, you know, as one of my council member colleagues always says, we don't know what we don't know. We don't know what's going on down there. And the fact that we don't seem to get the timely responses to some of these kinds of things raises questions about that. The fear of the unknown. Homes with small contaminations below the hurl or no contamination, but they're in the immediate area. I wonder if it's just a matter of time. Or I wonder if the testing has been accurate. Or wondering if the lab work has been accurate. And we've had all kinds of public discussion about that. Third bullet, public expectation that the only acceptable level of exposure or risk is no risk and zero contamination. I think there's no doubt about that. Many times, Jim Kelly, who is a very, very good and respectful, reliable guy at the health department, to explain how hurls are created and constructed and all the rest, the fact is the public listens. I still think that you want to go home and believe that somewhere we're going to get rid of this problem. And so zero is better than a 0.2 on vinyl chloride, for example. What's the role on the part of local governments? We don't have any statutory authority in Rome. Someone took an oath of office a number of years ago around things around life, health, safety, community welfare, and all the rest. And I know that I get some votes out of the community, so it made only sense that we would get involved. We have a shared responsibility with the state agency for human health. We had to go and remind them of that. We've participated with the MPCA in our invitation, or our encouragement, to work with them on drafting some recent fact documents. I think we can provide leadership in our own communities because of some of the background some of us actually have in these kinds of matters. And maybe our local residents will have some confidence in us doing it, which they may not have with some of the state agencies. The time commitment, as I indicated, is immeasurable. I hate to think back. I was looking the other day. We set some goals for 2006 and 2007. I hate to think of how many of those we didn't get to because of the time spent on this. When we started the year in 2005, we weren't going to spend a lot of time dealing with these kinds of matters. But I think it's important and imperative that the MPCA, through regulation or otherwise, recognize that there is a role for local officials in these kinds of matters. I was listening to the gentleman from St. Louis Park, and it only reminds me that we do have an action in these things. We have a stake in these things, and that is we represent the residents of our communities. And we do it more directly than anybody will at a state agency, and it's important we're at the table to do that. Last thought, a couple of my residents have been through this since 1993. Remind me that probably in about 94, 95, I was quoted as saying, I hope we'll never come back and have to deal with this thing again. And unfortunately, since 95 to the present time, it's probably taken multiple hours of more time and more extensive amounts of time and more frequent meetings on these kinds of matters, simply because things that should have gotten done haven't gotten done, and they haven't gotten done in a timely manner. What we know in 2008, as we're going through this proposed action from the MPCA, they called an amendment. We could have done that in 2004. We could have done that in 2005. We could have done that in 2006. We could have done it in 2007. We've pushed them for that. And that still hasn't happened in all that. We know nothing more today than we did in 2004, 2005. And we're not closer to an action. So, with that, anything that you want to ask or questions you may have? I will say, just as a way of a caveat, I'm not a lawyer, but you'd think I might be when I'm going to say this. A lot of these thoughts hopefully are attributed to me and not necessarily to the fact that I asked the council for a vote. And the second comment I'm going to make is Representative Moe is here, and I happen to own some property in the northern part of the state. And I would remind him that he's got an offer of some water issues at Bemidji State, who has spoken very well to some of these kinds of matters and the economic interests of players in water and drinking water and surface water all over the state, and we don't seem to be using that information.
Thanks very much. Let's see, Representative Lagunas and then Representative Bowman.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for coming. Your testimony is powerful, and I think it tells us that we need to do some follow-up, and I appreciate the chairs calling this committee and hope you consider calling the PCA up to talk about the matters that have been brought up. Because there's some issues with responsible parties here and some legal issues that almost seem to not end. And you may not want to get into them today, but I have liability issues that are scary. But I do see that the Department of Health is here. And my first question was that when you were looking in 1993 about HRL with regard to vinyl chloride, that's a long time ago. We found a lot in science about particularly impacts on children and on fetuses of things like vinyl chloride. So my first question is, has that HRL been updated? Number one, and it has it been updated to protect children's health? And I was wondering if we could ask the Department of Health to come up and answer that question.
Genius, I think Mayor Watson actually could tell you.
1993, the hurl on vinyl chloride is 0.08.
Point what?
0.08.
Okay.
And today it's 0.2. In other words, it's increased about a factor of 1.5 times.
You
mean that's two incidents per million in the lifetime of vulnerable adults and young children is the way they measure it. So we've raised the actual curl from what we had in 1993. Some of the 12 homes we had in 1993 would have not exceeded 0.2, but they did exceed
0.08. Let me follow up on that, just to make sure I understand. So it's less strict now than it was in 2000, I mean, in 1993 is less strict.
I don't know about the being less strict. All I know is math in this thing. The standard, the minimum is raised.
Then what I am thinking about, in 2001 we passed a law that said that our health standards should be based on the impact on children, with the assumption, of course, that if the kids are going to be okay, we adults are going to be just fine, thank you. So I would be interested in knowing if the health department has revisited this HRL with since 2001, and specifically looked at it with regard to children.
Can I give you two answers that I know, and folks in the health department, Jim Kelly and others, can tell you a lot more than I can. One is they just finished a review of some of the hurls on, I think, I can't tell you the number, but it was a number of EOCs, and I believe they've decided to leave this at point two at the moment for a lot of reasons. One is because of some of the science they're using and some of the other technologies that they're using today, in which I believe they have more confidence in the testing that's done with that standard. Secondly, the standard is created with young children and vulnerable adults. Standard is not based on healthy middle-aged Scandinavians and Germans.
Representative Wiggins.
Well, I would just follow up with one observation then. We had testimony from our larger Environment Finance Committee and a number of other committees, from Ken Cook from the Environmental Working Group out of Washington, D.C., and they were talking to us about folks saying, well, at part 1 point per million or 2 points per million, people come back and say, well, that's fine. That's really pretty low. And what he was demonstrating to us is that there are many pharmaceuticals that are directly given to us that act upon our bodies at much lower rates than 0.2. Far lower, 10 and 100 times lower. So that I don't feel comforted by knowing that it's 0.2 and that it was actually raised. I don't feel comforted for your community, because what can happen in your community can also happen in my community.
Let me add one fact to this, and I don't know the number offhand, but we have a number of homes who today would exceed the 0.08 if that were still the standard, who are not exceeding 0.2 today.
That troubles me.
In other words, that was the same criterion that produced 12 incidents in 93.
Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Mayor, for sharing your testimony. It's very compelling. And just to follow up on Representative Leganis' questions and comments, it is alarming that we're, in order to solve the problem as opposed to cleaning it up, we're just changing the rules. And I think that seems to be an issue that we've come in contact with quite often, dealing with water quality issues. Your friend in my district is my chairman of my department at the university in Kennedy, as well, so his research is one that I get reminded of repeatedly.
You got to pass that to suburban property owners up in your area.
Another comment and a question. I find it alarming, too, that, and no offense to you and your community, but with the capacity and the wherewithal that you have in North Oaks, if you still have not been able to resolve your issue, if you still have contamination, you still have households that the solution is bottled water, and then we have communities around the state of Minnesota with more severe contamination issues and far less capacity to deal with them. And the fact that we haven't solved your issue yet, it makes me wonder how long it's going to be, if ever, before we're able to get some of our communities that are impoverished or communities of color.
Let me just add a piece to it.
There was
the reason I gave you the information that there were 12 wells with that had well advisories placed on them in 1993, and the municipal solution was 60. Some of us took a look at an area and worked with the responsible parties, which are the same two, plus a land company in the area that owned some of the land to the north, and forged that solution through a negotiated process privately. It probably cost the RPs at the time, I suppose, $350,000 a piece or something rather. So it was a less than $1 million installation cost. But two things are important. One is there was not a member of the MPCA at the table. And number two, if we'd have worked off their order, I hate to tell you where we'd be today. I can't be sure we'd have had municipal water in place, I can tell you that.
Chairman, just another follow-up question, and I think I know the answer. We have a tax bill now that has a continuation of the D tax that Ramsey County uses for
light.
for cleanup of contaminated soil. I know it's a drop in the bucket, but is that money of use to you at all? And have you accessed that?
I'm not even aware of it. No, we haven't accessed it. And in our case, really the expense in the local community might be some of the private testing individual homeowners have done above and beyond what they've done as part of the MPCA protocol. Or in some cases, simply buying bottled water themselves, but they're not at a hurl or they're not at a point where they're getting even a well advisory. And then, as a city, we have retained our own advisories, whether it be engineers and some legal counsel, to help us through some of these matters over time. But that's it at this point. So,
I was going to make a couple of comments. When I first ran for office in 2004, I started hearing about this situation and following it and talking to some of the local residents, and you know, these are folks with PhDs and attorneys, and they have been banging their heads against the wall on this for years. And when we see timely, although very difficult, decisions being made in other parts of the metro, the East Metro and St. Louis Park, it just still kind of confounds me still. And one of them was around this decision document process, the NDD. I was trying to find out what the legal basis for it is. Is it legally binding for the responsible parties and so on? And it really is just an action document that says this is what the agency will do and compel the parties to do. And just last week, I attended a public meeting where the amendment was rolled out to say, okay, here's what we're going to do now. And it didn't provide any of the decisiveness that the D stands for that people were looking for. And a lot of folks are talking about whether they're going to be able to sell their house or not. And the agency said, well, we've now framed it so there's some flexibility, so if other houses have wells that are contaminated, then we'll kind of see what we do. Maybe we'll acquire deeper wells. Maybe we'll look at the municipal water supply. We'll just sort of see what happens. And that wasn't really what people were looking for. They were looking for some more black and white than gray, and they've been kind of frustrated about that. This is one reason that I put in my House File 3238 bill, my drinking water bill, the idea of an ombudsman at the PCA who actually can help people sort through all these things and cut down on the time. And it, when you realize that it's been, was it 2004 when I think the... October of 2004 when one of the wells on the west side of this lake where we thought there wasn't really a problem was flagged, and we're still in 2008 and there hasn't been any resolution. And there's been a feasibility study done that says here are the options, you know, from do nothing to drill deeper wells to city water supply, and in the grand scheme of things, the cost is not that different, and people are just sort of looking for that decisiveness and say, well, can we just dissolve this and just do it? So there isn't any legislation I can think of that will impose judgment. I think the word judgment was one that you used, and we're still frustrated. So you had a couple Representative Owen and Representative Virginia.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mayor, you might have touched on this a little bit before, and I'm dealing with a similar issue up in my district now in Cass Lake. And the responsible party has very deep pockets and difficult to hold accountable. Maybe could you just, you said the two parties are not in Minnesota. How much interaction have you had with them? And I mean, have there been any
responsibility assigned to them? Is there is there lawsuits ongoing? You know, is this something that you all are going to have to bear on your own with state help, or
Chairman, if I can answer that in probably two ways. One is, there aren't any lawsuits going on that I'm aware of. There were three responsible parties initially, and one of them was the owner of the landfill and the refuse company. We had no means, and of course they had some settlements between the two RPs, which is Reynolds and Whirlpool, to take them out of this thing. And so then the two national firms stepped in place of the third. We had to answer your question in two ways. The RPs, through their engineering firm, Conestoga Rovers, basically does everything the MPC asks them to. And in some cases, even advances a motion or two. I've been able to maintain some relationships with the national environmental people for both those organizations because I've been around so long. And the irony is, there's only four of us left that were still around in 1993, which probably is a scary thought. But it happens to be myself being the only government one, and everybody else representing the RPs and their engineers. So I've tried to maintain a relationship with them. I think some of the things we have gotten done through cajoling and negotiation and sort of being in their face and some of those kinds of things exceeded what I would have expected we would have gotten done had we waited for the MPCA action. 60 Wells as an example. Some of the vertical profiling and some of the other stuff that's been going on here in this 2000 period. None of that would have happened or happened as timely had we not been pushing it ourselves. And so we maintained some dialogue with them. So they've been responsive to us, not contrary to that. Frustration is, why isn't the MPCA doing that? So you have to represent the Gardner's comment. You know, most of what they do, they talk to us as their authority is found in policy, or their authority is found in whatever they compose or write. I'm not even sure that that's true. Because I can't get an answer from the Attorney General about this municipal water action in 1983.
I can tell you the community has tied itself in knots on this one. Representative Virginia.
Generally speaking, all water laws are very good. The lack is enforcement. And so perhaps one of the things that we need to do is to review the water laws that actually would impact on this particular situation. I am also thinking about the rules which have the force and effect of law that say no degradation of groundwater. And if the PCA is sitting on its duff and allowing degradation, does that mean that the state becomes a responsible party? I mean, there are some implications here that are large and scary. And I only bring this up because there was in DNR, there was a failure to enforce a rule for years and years and years. This just happened. And, I mean, the failure to enforce gone on for a long time. And so one party sued another party over a wetland. And the local judge brought in DNR as a party. The parties just sued each other. And the local judge said, well, DNR, you have the deep pockets, you pay. And that's our budget, of course, that we have to fund. And so we're very interested in that kind of thing. Local judges can do that kind of thing. So I think it would, I hope you have an opportunity to pursue the legal issues here. We have wonderful legal counsel to this committee. And maybe that would be the beginning of
House File 3238 on disclosure, too, which I was talking to the realtor today. Representative Mo.
Just a follow-up question. I think that's really interesting, too, your relationship with the environmental, probably the lead for those two corporations. You've been able to cajole cooperation. The cynic in me wonders, what your hammer was. It's been very difficult for us to accomplish similar things. We have either members of your community on the board,
Not that I'm aware of.
I did not win the North Oaks precinct. Representative Muller.
But there's another election this year.
Well, I don't know. There could be some CEOs. I don't know. But Mayor Watson.
We've got, Mr. Chairman, we've got some of us that don't understand the word no very well. And I think it's just being persistent. This is an issue that, as a public official, we can't be wrong. I mean, there's nothing we can do that wouldn't be enough. So the fact is that we're in their face all the time and try to maintain the relationships that we have, or I have, means that I do get a phone call from the environmental folks at Reynolds when I think that it's time to move, get something done. I actually was going to hold a public hearing and talk to the council about doing so, inviting those folks to town. They wanted to come back and visit the community, see how things were going. I was going to actually invite a public hearing and let them come in and take testimony from the public. I think WCCO could have been there. Mr. Escalade might have been and found that fun.
I would note that anti-corporate rhetoric does not work in North Oaks very well. No, never. Well, I don't anyway, but I noticed there's just a lot of tension in the relationship with 3M and the state and some legislators on the East Metro issue, and you don't really see that here. It actually is very intriguing that the city and the responsible parties actually could probably hammer something out if the agency would be decisive in some fashion. So it's a very unusual situation.
Mr. Chairman, can I just leave one thought that came up when Representative Newman touched on one of my other favorite issues, which is the DNR. Some of you that live in the Twin Cities know that there's a plan in place for Minneapolis-St. Paul Municipal Water Services to get together and provide a capacity for about 50 million gallons of water a day in their combined services. And part of that was to drill 12 deep wells in the northeast metro, in other words, in Little Canada and part of Roseville and the northern part of St. Paul. We were not involved in any of that. We weren't even advised of it, other than the fact that they were ready to go to a public hearing sometime, and we got noticed in all of that. What we discovered is that nobody had done any testing to determine the drawdown impact in our particular community. Nobody had worried about the fact that any plumes might, the movement of the plume might be altered with 50 million gallons of water from the pumps. And the fact is that we interceded on that one as well, only to discover that there was some impact. And here's the DNR and the MPCA both dealing with one with groundwater and for municipal purposes and an appropriation issue, and the other one dealing with a contaminated site, and they're not even talking to each other less than a mile apart.
I do need to get to the other two cities, but I think this was what triggered me to even talk to Representative Lagunas about forming this subcommittee, because this is an excellent cross-section of a whole range of issues that we need to deal with, and I don't have time to list them all, but everything from data standards to communication to legal remedies. So,
Representative Mullen, I can talk about drinking water and around lake property someday, too.
It's
going to be another whole day for you.
Great Caribou and North Oaks, Representative Mullen, you can meet up there. Well, thank you, Mayor Watson, for coming.
Maybe on the lake.
I've got Dean Johnson from Lake Elmo.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you very much for conducting this meeting. I'm a firm believer that it's always a good idea to monitor process and make sure that your processes are working and improving.
I could have you state your name.
My name is Dean Johnson. I'm the mayor of the city of Lake Elmo. I've been on the city council there for 6 years, the last four as mayor. I'm going to try to be not sound Pollyanna, but I do want to start out with compliments to the Minnesota Department of Health and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. As you all know, we in Lake Elmo have felt the effect of three major groundwater contaminations, two from landfills, one public, one private, and the other one from a point source where someone simply dumped used solvents down an empty well. We've been working with them for 4 years. Their performance has been very, very strong, very positive. Their communication has been similar. We have had nothing but cooperation We work together on planning public meetings and public communication, and a lot of people like to complain about how ineffective and inefficient government is, and I'm pleased to report that on these three problems, we certainly have not experienced that with our problem. I'd like to add one other thing about 3M. I think that most people are not aware of. When we first discovered the PFC contamination problem 4 years ago, we met with 3M. We explained to them that we had two neighborhoods that had significantly contaminated water, and they stepped up to the plate. They provided Lake Elmo with $5 million to bring municipal water to two communities that had contamination problems. Now, unfortunately, the municipal water system wasn't within 5 miles of there, and we didn't have a place to build a tank and extend our system. So in addition to the $5 million, they donated another 8 acres of prime real estate. So 3M actually contributed between $7 and $8 million to bring water, municipal water, to 216 homes. And that's in addition to the $8 million that they are currently agreeing to contribute to the landfill cleanup project. So I think our public-private partnership has been working very well, both with the two agencies as well as with 3M. Okay, so the question I think that you really wanted to talk about is, how do we improve the problem-solving process? Right, and there is an area where I think there is some opportunity for improvement. My understanding of the legislation or legislative objective relative to these groundwater problems has been to provide a permanent solution to the contamination problem so that we would not pass this contamination on to future generations. And I want you to know I applaud that as an objective. The concern that I have, and I think it's being addressed, but it's not completely resolved, is that the PCA has come to you with a solution that they felt was the most economical, and it was the one that was most likely to pass and get funding. But in a lot of people's estimation, including the City Council in Lake Elmo, the dig and line option, simply as originally proposed, it does not appear to be a permanent solution. Now, as I understand, because of meetings like this, the questions have been brought up and they've been dealt with, and I think the meetings like this have really done a lot to clear the air with those kind of inconsistencies. We hope that you will continue to monitor the legislation that will address the groundwater problems in Lake Elmo so that the final solution is a permanent one, not something that will simply have to be repeated when the bonding is paid for in 20 or 30 years. I think there's been progress made. Of course, the legislation hasn't passed yet, and we haven't implemented it, but I think we've made very good progress. So I don't want to oversimplify the situation, but I think that we have seen, because we had three major contaminations, we've seen government responsive as government should be responsive. Thank you.
Thank you. Certainly, the bonding bill is coming through this week, so we'll see how it goes. A question?
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Let's see, I've got folks from Lakeland. And we have a former member with us there. If you could state your name and title for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Peg Larson, L-A-R-S-E-N, and I'm here as a council member from the city of Lakeland. And I would say right up front that I am not here representing the council of the city of Lakeland. I'm here more to give you a history of what we ran into with underground water pollution. I had been on the council for 5 months, elected in January of 1987, when we found out that we had three plumes of contamination in our city. So as you can guess, it was quite a shock and quite a learning experience. We'll also let you know that I then became mayor during this time and was mayor for 4 years and then came here and had the honor to serve as a representative and served with some of you. And now I am a lobbyist, but I have been appointed back to our city council. So I'm kind of going totally around my life in a very interesting way. Lakeland is a city of 2,000 people. We're 17.5 miles east of St. Paul. It's 7 square miles. If you go across the Hudson Bridge, you're the Lakeland Bridge, to Hudson, you're going right through the northern part of Lakeland. It was established in 1840. It had its biggest growth period between 1950 and 1970. In 1960, the Minnesota Department of Health issued a nitrate advisory to the city, which at that point in time was not taken to be any big deal. It meant that some of the water might not be safe for infants, and nothing was actually done. In 1986, Lakeland was informed that there was a problem with private wells, and this stemmed from the fact that we had a truck stop at the top of the hill in Lakeland, and it had leakage of petroleum. So the PCA was watching at that point in time and doing some test wells. In 1987, we were informed that we had 10 wells with VOCs, and this was announced on Memorial Day. We had the PCA issued in press release, electronic and print, wells in Lakeland contaminated with unsafe levels of VOCs, and that's a quote. Now, I'm going to really try to pronounce these chemicals. Representative Gardner, you can correct me if I'm wrong. The chemicals that they found were trichlorofluoromethane, trichloroethylene, TCE, dichloroethane, dibromethane, dichlorodifluoromethane, benzene, and others. And you can imagine
we'll
mark that for you. Did I do it? Good. Thank you. Practice. Actually, these come from solvents, degreasers, petroleum, non-petroleum products, and some are found in household cleaners. So what we found out was that we had leakage from what we thought was the Lakeland dump or the petroleum from the truck stop. We had another plume of unknown contamination site that had all of these things in it, and we had nitrates. So we were dealing with three different plumes of pollution throughout our city, a fairly small city. You can imagine the panic that ensued after that. We had meetings in our school hall. We had people that were threatening our lives as if that we had done this ourselves. You come into a community where generation after generation of people have lived and have used their wells for generation after generation, and you tell them that their wells are going to be capped because they're contaminated. People really are not happy. We were given a few different options by the PCA as to what to do. We were told we could do nothing, which didn't sound like a very good option. We could put in carbon filtration systems underneath people's sinks, which also the council voted against because the fear was that people wouldn't remember to change the filter, or if the house changed hands, that the new people might not realize the importance of monitoring that filter. We were told that we could do a cluster well. We were told that we could have bottled water forever, or that we could put in a municipal system. The council did vote to assess all members of the city to build a municipal system, and I can tell you right now that was not a popular vote. But it was then, and I believe now, was the fairest way to treat it. We did put in a municipal system. We now have two tanks. We not only serve Lakeland, but we serve St. Croix Beach and Lakeland Shores, and hopefully other parts of the valley if contamination is found. One very interesting fact, when the PCA came to speak to us, the geologist talked about the fact that the plumes of pollution would not reach the St. Croix River for at least 100 years. I live on the St. Croix River, and in 11 years, the pollution was on either side of me. So we all hooked up to city water. There are very few people left in Lakeland that are not hooked up to city water, mainly out of fear. I would also like to say that we talk about this as a problem that we can solve. Right now, Lakeland is facing the question of what's going to happen to the fly ash from the King Coal plant and where they're going to be able to dump it in West Lakeland Township. We are at the Mount Simon Aquifer, which is the bottom aquifer. We have nowhere else to go. So right now, they're doing a study about whether Xcel can dump their fly ash in a place that may well get into our aquifer. Also, the 3M problem, our public works director, Mr. Jim Gillis, tests our water at least twice a week for the chemicals from 3M just to make sure that they have not once again come down into Lakeland as we are the natural flow. I would also like to let you know that in your folders you have a CD that Jennifer put there. It was done by our former mayor, E. Craig Morris, and it gives you a much better in-depth history of exactly what happened in our city and what kind of hurdles we had to overcome. One hurdle was in the EPA itself. They fought for about 3 or 4 months over which department was actually going to handle our pollution. Not whether we had pollution, but who was going to oversee it. I think that education is probably one of the key factors here of all local officials, and I think vigilance. So I thank you, Representative Gardner, and all the members of this committee for still looking into this problem and not thinking it's something that's going to go away. Let's stand for questions.
I remember you telling me that National Guard tanker truck came into your community in the beginning. Was that the sort of the emergency response?
Well, Mr. Chair, that was the first response we were given when we found that we had contamination and it was scattered throughout the city. And there's nothing more frightening than driving past your city hall and seeing a huge National Guard tank and people with their big jugs coming to get fresh water because they were afraid to drink their own water. And quite truthfully, nobody really knew which wells were contaminated. We had two neighbors that died within a month of each other from cancer, two different forms of cancer, one at the age of 61, one at the age of 40. Of course, this was said to be unrelated. I can't say that it was related, but it was a strange coincidence. And we've never looked at the cancer rate in Lakeland to decide whether that was a factor. But these are all the chemicals that we were ingesting, and these people both had lived there their entire lifetime. I think it's very questionable.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for coming to testify and let us know your story. I'm wondering, is there a way that you've been able to determine if there was one major polluter there? You know, I understand the benzene and the solvents and the degreasers, so we're talking about mostly industrial waste, I would assume. But has anyone determined who did that dumping back then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Falsey, what the PCA decided was that with the three different plumes, the one being a mixed plume, they thought that was things that maybe people put down their drains and that they really couldn't prove that. There was a question of whether the Lakeland landfill, which is out of commission for many, many years, was a part of the plume, and who knows what went in there, quite truthfully. And then there was Race Truck Stop up on the hill, which we know those tanks were leaking, and that was the petroleum. So it was kind of a, nobody could quite answer which one came from where. I know they tried to go after Race Truck Stop. They aerated that area, and then they decided that this was such a large mess that it would take 100 years to clean it, so they stopped. So they went after the truck stop, but they were bankrupt. There was no money there to be had. So, and I will tell you that I told Representative Gardner, I have been retired from here for 8 years, and I have masterfully managed not to testify in any committee, and this, I feel that passionately about this, that I really want to do, let you know what has happened in the history and watch you go forward.
Other questions? Representative Clark.
I am so sorry. I've had to go back and forth between two committees, and I apologize. And I missed your testimony. Except to hear you say that there seemed to be an incidence of cancer that kind of unexplained. Is that the gist of what you were talking about?
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, yes. We had two very strange cases of cancer. One was 61. The gentleman was 40. And there were two different types of cancer that lived next door to each other. And they were in one of the plumes. Now, at that time, nobody put anything together, but many, many questions were asked. But we have not followed any cancer incidents in Lakeland. And we're a town of 2,000. I imagine we easily could do that, but we have not.
Just maybe a comment to the chair and the committee and to you as well, which is for years, and some people on our public health committee know, we have been struggling to try to do some public health tracking of cancer. We've met total resistance from our state agencies. And last year we actually forced through in the conference committee a provision that they will start to make spaces in on a forum for recording, you know, cancer is a reportable disease, so that they will start to record, because they do not yet. Places of residence that a person who has a cancer registry entry have would be asked by their physician or nurse or whatever. Places of residence and places of work. Real basic, occupational and residential exposure. We would know, we would be able to tell you more, and we would probably know a lot more about many of our communities if we had that sort of thing. So I just want to mention that to you, because you certainly deserve to have that kind of information, and we need to, in order to do that, we just need to have a public health commitment to track it, and we don't do that yet. Thank you, Representative Clark. I appreciate that. I wish that we did have those facts, because I feel in my heart that there is a piece.
I want to take my hat off to Representative Bunn for working so aggressively on biomonitoring legislation. I'll say before anybody else leaves the room, I wanted to make sure we did the minutes. But did anyone else have any other questions or comments?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Let's see. Representative Clark, would you like to move the minutes for November 8th and December 19th?
Chair, I'll move those 2 minutes.
All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Okay. Was there anyone else who would care to give any input? We have the room for a little bit longer. Ms. Ohanessian, would you like to please do? We did say in the meeting notice on the web that we were interested from city officials as well as residents who have had to deal with the issue. And if you could just state your name and where you're from for the record, please.
My name is Judy Ohanessian, and I'm a resident of North Oaks. I live on West Shore Road on the west side of the lake that Mayor Watson was speaking about concerning the contamination. And I would like to just read to the committee an excerpt from a letter that I had written to Senator Rummel as well as Representative Gardner and McFarland almost a year ago. And many of the situations haven't changed, so I think it's still quite relevant. Mayor Watson had spoken many times about the Minnesota decision document. And I just have some perspectives on that. Had I known about the existence of that document and the history of this Superfund site when I bought my home on West Shore Road, I would have taken some comfort in reading that a remedy was in the document that would have been implemented if a health advisory was issued on the west side of the lake as a result of the periodic monitoring that had been specified in that document. In other words, I could have assessed the risk of buying a home in my community, knowing that an approved document provided a remedy should the worst case scenario occur. It's very disconcerting to know that this document may not be worth the paper it's printed on if the MPCA can amend it when the worst case scenario does indeed present itself. It appears that the MPCA will indeed amend the document, and it's imperative that we ensure that appropriate remedies are included in the document. I have often thought of the conversation a homeowner would have with a prospective buyer of their home. It would go like this. There's a plume under the lake in front of our house. It contains vinyl chloride. It's a known carcinogen. The experts say it will indeed affect more homes in this part of North Oaks. The experts can't tell us when this will happen, nor how toxic the levels will really be. There's an MDD in place that provides a remedy for residents. Unfortunately, the MPCA can amend this document. So I really can't tell you if you'll be left owning a home with a drinking water well, that is safe for your family to drink. Please buy my house anyway. And I think that's really the situation that many of the residents, not only in North Oaks, but in many of the other communities are in. Thank you very much.
say OG. Okay. Any other questions for gentlemen? Anybody else interested? Well, thanks for coming. I was thinking we might do this after committee deadlines in about 10 days, but Representative Hansen canceled his buffers committee for this time slot, so we were able to take advantage of it. Now I'm going to go unlock him from the closet I put him in so he couldn't ever see it. So this is not actually the regular meeting time, but I think we may have one or two other meetings before the end of session. So thanks, everybody, for coming. And meeting.